From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia. I'm Bill Nygut. Today, in an extended interview with the AJC, attorney Ashley Merchant explained how she arrived at the difficult decision to file motions to have Fannie Willis removed from the Trump election conspiracy case. And she revealed the personal toll that decision has taken on her. Tamar Hallerman joins us to discuss the interview.
I'm Tia Mitchell in Washington. The U.S. House is in recess right now, but before they left town, Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a warning shot across the bow of Speaker Mike Johnson. She threatened to call a vote to dismiss him from his leadership post if he didn't get the line with the priorities of the most conservative members. I'll take a look at her latest moment in the national spotlight.
And with the legislative session coming to an end tomorrow, we'll talk with House Majority Leader Chuck F. Strachan and Democratic Representative Mary Margaret Oliver. We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Welcome to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Politically Georgia, where we aim to set the stakes and the agenda for Georgia politics weekday mornings. I'm Bill Nygut, along with my co-host in Washington, Tia Mitchell. Tia, it's kind of lonely up there right now, isn't it? Both the Senate and the House, I think, are out for like 2 weeks, right?
Yes, they're out, but I am enjoying this quieter. It's not completely quiet, but I have a big story I've been trying to wrap up, so it's been good to get some writing done.
Do you want to give us a preview, or is this secret?
No, secret.
All right. Well, once it breaks, we know we'll be able to talk about it with you on Politically Georgia, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Tia, we got into some insights about Ashley Merchant, the attorney for one of the Trump election conspiracy defendants, in an extended interview that Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman of our team did. They wrote about it in the AJC. It's also, you can listen to it on their podcast Breakdown. But Tia, we're going to have Tamar Hallerman join us right now so we can talk a little bit more about what it was like to do that conversation. Tamar, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here in studio, finally. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the reasons we really thought it was good to have you come in is I learned so much about Ashley Merchant, not only how she approached this bombshell motion that she filed, which included the kind of sordid details, romantic details that maybe people, you know, were a little uncomfortable with. So I learned from you guys how she did that, and we'll talk about it. But we also learned a bit about how it affected her personally. Yes?
Yeah, exactly. She talked about some of the phone calls and threatening messages she got. She received. She also got kind of Google bombed, I guess might be the term. Tons of negative reviews about her law firm designed to hurt her future business prospects. But the longer I cover this story, the more and more interested I am in people's motivations and kind of their what the narratives that are in their head as we're going through all of these amazing twists and turns in this case. And I feel like this interview was such an interesting way in on all of that.
I think is it fair to say you felt she really opened up to you?
Yeah, it sure seemed like it. She talked a little bit about some of the fear that she had right before she filed that big motion on January 8th, how she got there from those initial rumors and initial digging she was doing all the way until when she filed that motion, and even what was going through her head in court during some of those amazing exchanges with D.A. Willis.
She said, I quote from the interview, "I didn't feel like I had a lot of choice to file this motion. What if I don't file it and my client gets convicted and he goes to prison? First of all, I have to be okay with that. But second of all, I have to be on the witness stand one day in a habeas hearing explaining why I had this document, the document that revealed information about the relationship and the money that changed hands and the vacations they took," right? She felt she had no choice but to do this.
Yeah, she believes that, you know, this is part of her constitutional duty to defend her clients to the best of her abilities. And she kind of, in as many words, said she didn't think she could sleep at night if she didn't bring this forward, given the corroboration that she felt that she had.
Tia?
So, Tamar, again, award-winning Breakdown podcast has done it again. Can you tell us, I'm just curious, how did the interview with Merchant come about? Did it take her a while to agree to sit down, or was she always game? How difficult was it to get her on the record?
Well, we, of course, have been dying to talk to her since this bombshell motion came out on January 8th. But understandably, she did not want to talk while all of this was playing out in court. And of course, a lot of this information was coming out in real time. So she mentioned during this interview, even one of her, I don't know if regrets was the best word, but she talked about receiving the cell phone records from Nathan Wade kind of in the middle of the hearing process. She wished she would have been able to receive that earlier to be able to present that. So I think in the middle of all of that evidentiary hearing and waiting for the judge to decide, I think a lot of folks didn't want to talk to us because we, you know, not everything was on the table yet. So we were so excited when she was willing to talk and do this for Breakdown. And we're hoping others might want to come forward too.
I want to talk about some of what she told you, but before we do, in terms of the specifics, tell us a little bit about Ashley Merchant, who she is, how long she's been practicing law. At one point, I know in the interview, as an example of her legal practice, she said that the first day she was in court with Nathan Wade and Fonnie Willis, they all hugged because they were kind of this close-knit legal community. They all knew each other. So she has a long history as a defense attorney.
Yeah, she and her husband, John, have a practice together in Marietta. She's pretty well known, especially in Cobb County. That's how she knows Nathan Wade. And it seems like those two in particular had a friendship. She campaigned for him when he ran for a judgeship, I believe in 2016. And before she was a defense attorney, she was a public defender stretched really thin with all of these cases she had been assigned. And at the beginning of our interview, if you go in and listen, she talks about how she was having a hard time getting bond deals for people. And a lot of her clients were sitting in jail sometimes for years before their trial began. And so she talks about learning about the power of speedy trial demands and how she used that, tried to kind of break the system a little bit to try and get justice for her clients. And that seems to be a bit of a theme in her career, in that she's not afraid to question the power structure. You know, the judges that she feel like might not be giving her clients a shot. She went all the way to the Georgia Supreme Court to allow them to hire expert witnesses for public defenders who are defending a lot of these clients for very little money. And so that's a theme, and it kind of shows it, the through line to this is that she's not afraid to go after arguably the second most powerful law enforcement official in Georgia, Fonnie Willis.
Yeah, Tia, jump in.
So I want to ask probably the part that is most frustrating for Attorney Merchant and became kind of one of the big points of the hearing on disqualifying D.A. Willis was Terrence Bradley's testimony. And when she sat down with you, she talked about being so frustrated by him. So I guess, can you tell me what she told you about the fact that she came to the conclusion that either he didn't tell her the truth initially, or he didn't tell the truth on the stand, but she thinks it was on the stand when he wasn't telling the truth.
Let's remind our listeners, Terrence Bradley was going to be, Ashley Merchant thought, her star witness, because he was going to have information about among other things, when the relationship actually started, as opposed to what they claimed was the starting point. They claimed it wasn't until after he came in as special prosecutor. And so Ashley Merchant thought, I've got it. This guy is going to be my absolute star witness.
Yeah, Terrence Bradley is the former law partner and briefly served as the divorce attorney for Nathan Wade. And as you mentioned, was supposed to be the star witness. Merchant had been texting with him extensively throughout her investigation into all of this. And as we later found out after these texts became public, you know, it felt like he was kind of, you know, saying this is absolutely true. This definitely started earlier than what they're saying. You should talk to this person, this person, this person who will be able to back me up. And Merchant talks about how frustrated she was given how forthcoming he was in private. And Terrence Bradley, again, was a friend who she'd known a really long time in Cobb County. Once he got on the stand, all of a sudden he's citing attorney-client privilege, which she said, had she known that he was going to do that, she would have approached things a lot more differently. But yeah, it turned out to be an immensely frustrating experience for her, Tia. She talks about, you know, she felt like there was pressure being applied to him. And it ended up becoming a really frustrating experience. And Judge McAfee, in his ruling the other week, mentioned how he couldn't put any stock in Bradley's testimony and how he felt that that was too flimsy a foundation for the defense to make their disqualification argument.
Yeah, Tamara, along those same lines, so you mentioned that Ashley Merchant said she considered herself friends with Willis and Wade and they had a better, you know, better interactions early on before she brought this motion. But then she also seemed to rely really heavily on Terrence Bradley and how he described the Willis-Wade relationship. Did Attorney Merchant say she had any indication that Willis and Wade had a personal relationship? Like, how much personal insight did she have into the nature of Willis and Wade's relationship?
She said she was not aware of this when she started looking into, she was not aware of the relationship when she started looking into all of this. She said her way in is, as somebody who knew Nathan Wade pretty well, she said she was kind of surprised that DA Willis would hire him for this case, given that he doesn't have experience prosecuting a lot of felonies, a lot of complex cases like that involving the state's RICO law. So she started in on it that way. And it was only after she began digging around, speaking with folks like Terrence Bradley, where that became clear to her. And the DA's office didn't admit that relationship until weeks after Merchant filed her initial motion. That came in a court filing in early February.
Anybody who watched that cross-examination, which is what it ended up being, he became a hostile witness, although, you know, because he wasn't answering the questions the way she thought he would. Felt that Bradley was really dancing around all of this. And I remember asking Anthony Michael Kreis, who, you know, Georgia State professor of law, who you've obviously reported about his thoughts about the trial in your reporting. We've had him on the show. I remember asking him that without a definite proof that Bradley is lying on the stand, was McAfee able to make his own decision as he watched the testimony as to whether he thought Bradley was being truthful? And in fact, McAfee did write about that, saying he basically didn't believe a lot of what Bradley said when he wrote his ruling on all this, right?
Yeah, certainly. And he had a lot of tough decisions to make, the judge, in deciding who was lying, who wasn't, where the gray area is. One of the issues before him was to also decide if he felt like the DA and Nathan Wade were being truthful about the start of their relationship. And he often declined to make those rulings, although he did cast some doubts about the judgment of the DA and about the veracity of some of her claims. But it was interesting that he made the conclusion that, you know, Bradley, he couldn't take stock in any of that. So that was certainly interesting. And I mean, one thing about Bradley is you could tell he was just trying to hold on to his law license after all of that, because he was caught in such a tricky situation. If he was worried about privilege, he shouldn't have been talking to Ashley Merchant in the first place. So you could tell that he felt a little trapped by that and was trying to wiggle his way out of it, which of course made him a bad witness for the defense.
I want to talk a little bit about the personal side of all this. We talked about your conversation yesterday on the show a little, and I said that when Ashley Merchant talks about she but it told you that she's never been called a liar as often as she has since all of this, since she filed her motion. She's gotten other kinds of threatening messages, I guess. And I said on the show yesterday that we think about that largely in terms of the far right coming after people who are on the left, who are critical of Donald Trump. We think of the white supremacists and their attacks on liberals and that sort of thing. We don't think very often about what happens to someone like Ashley Merchant when the left comes after her.
Yeah, I mean, she's been described as a tool of the Republican Party, a tool of Donald Trump, a liar, a racist. I mean, and she talked about how hard that was. And she said, you know, Trump's people had nothing to do with what she was doing. Her own client didn't really either. This was all her and her investigation. But you're right, the torrent of angry messages. I've gotten many too, asking me why we would cover this issue at all, why we would cover this fight. And so it's been a trying couple of months, you know, following this story and trying to determine where the line is and how to write about this in a responsible way.
So that was something that brings up something, Tamar, when you said, you know, her client didn't ask her to do this. She did it on her own based on her own research. Did she tell you, how did she find out? Like, did she just happen to be looking through all these documents related to Nathan Wade's divorce? How did she find this out?
My understanding was it was through her conversations with Terrence Bradley, and she was looking for people who could help corroborate what he was saying. And that eventually led her to Robin Yerdy, who was the former employee in the Fulton DA's office, friend of the DA, who rented out that condo to Fannie Willis, who said that she saw them being affectionate earlier than what was said.
You know, I'm interested in the fact that you have been on the receiving end of people criticizing you and Bill and Shannon McCaffrey, who's joined you on a lot of these stories, for even reporting on this. And I will tell you, I have a good friend, an African-American woman, who has sent me innumerable messages when we've talked about this on the show, saying just that. This is the sort of thing, it's an attempt to undermine a Black woman who chooses to have a personal relationship that should be nobody's business but their own. And to frame it in that kind of racial and gender terms is really fascinating to me. And you've been on the receiving end of that too, you say.
Yeah, absolutely. And another common argument I've heard is that, well, this doesn't affect the underlying case. This doesn't have to do with Trump's guilt or innocence. Why do we care about this? And my argument is, look, this isn't us, you know, in an extracurricular way, looking into her sex life. I don't care about that. But this was part of a court motion that was filed that had to do, you know, that questioned her judgment, questioned whether she was a disinterested prosecutor. It questioned whether clients were getting due process. And it was something that the judge pretty quickly said he had to hold a hearing on. Because there was questions about fact. So we had a responsibility to cover this, in my opinion. We tried to not peddle in the salacious as much as we could, but a lot of this was playing out in official court filings. And so, it was certainly a tricky moment, but I also felt like it was our job to inform the public about a legal debate that was playing out in real time in a courtroom.
A bombshell. Legal filing it was and, playing out.
And one that the DA didn't always handle the best. Remember, for the first few weeks, she didn't even answer head on the central allegation of whether she had a personal relationship with Special Prosecutor Wade. So a lot of that stuff was just out there, allowing kind of the rumor mill to keep churning without any facts. So, Tamar, I wanted to ask, let's take a step back, get back to the wider case. What are you guys looking for? What's next? There is a potential some other things that could slow things down from what I understand. But Judge McAfee says he's going to continue to do what he can in the meantime.
Absolutely, Tia. A couple of things on the agenda. First of all, we're watching to see when the defense is going to appeal this ruling from Judge McAfee on whether to disqualify the DA. They're looking for the Court of Appeals to take up this case. They have until Monday, I believe, to appeal that ruling. So we're going to be watching out for that. And after that, of course, we're going to be watching to see if the appeals court wants to take up the issue. Other than that, tomorrow there's going to be a hearing in Judge McAfee's courtroom having to do with some other unrelated pretrial motions. So the case is moving ahead, at least in earnest, while we wait for the appeal to play out. And of course, we're waiting for any indication in terms of timing when a trial could begin, whether Judge McAfee is willing to lay a marker on this. Of course, we're waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to take up the question of presidential immunity in the Jack Smith January 6th case, which will impact the case here in Georgia because Trump is making that same argument locally. So there's a lot of moving parts here. And really, we're getting to a time crunch here because there's these three other criminal trials, which are in different stages of delay. One is beginning on April 15th in Manhattan. And so is there any time or any space for a case to begin in Fulton, especially so close to the election?
You mentioned Judge McAfee. I'm correct, I think, but you'll tell me if I'm wrong, that when the defense lawyers, Ashley Merchant, Steve Sadow, whoever else was involved, went to him and said, we want to appeal your ruling, he had some discretion in to certify that. Is that correct? He did not necessarily have to tell them they could move forward with it.
He basically has to give permission for them to appeal.
Yes.
So he granted that. But the appeals court still has to decide to take it up. They needed permission basically on two sides.
Sure. But the reason I'm mentioning that is that McAfee could have said, I feel my ruling is perfectly sound. We really need to get on with this trial. And that raises this interesting question about Scott McAfee, who you know better than we do. When he started this, when he got this case, it was like, this is this young guy in his mid-30s. He's a new judge. Is he going to be able to handle this? And from an outsider's point of view, he's been so methodical. He's moved with such caution, but also deliberation, so that when he decided to certify their petition to appeal, it isn't surprising because he really does want to dot his I's and cross his T's, yes?
Sure, but throughout this process with this disqualification motion, you have started hearing allies of the DA quietly at first and now much more loudly are beginning to criticize him. Why did you allow these evidentiary hearings to play out so that we could hear all these salacious details about the DA and her life? Why are you allowing him to appeal? So there is starting to be a little bit of pushback, but you're right, Bill. Overall, he has been really cautious and methodical in all of this, and he doesn't want to be overturned on appeals, so he's making sure everything's in line.
So given that he's getting some criticism, he's on the ballot in May.
Yes, he is.
He's got opposition. He's running in a heavily Democratic county, Fulton County. You don't have any reason. Look, we've got to take Judge McAfee at his word that politics isn't on the top of his mind here. But nevertheless, it's the sort of thing that fuels what people in the DA's office might say is you're giving favorable treatment to the Trump conspiracy defendant.
And these judicial races are nonpartisan, so it's not like there's an R or D next to his name.
Yeah.
And in general, the public tends to tune out of these judicial races, and often the incumbents, almost every time, the incumbents cruise to victory. So it'll be interesting to see how many people know his name, recognize his name, want to punish him in any way. But in general, he is the odds-on favorite. He has two opponents for his seat. We'll see if they have any traction. May is the election day, so there's not a whole lot of time.
Yeah. Tia, we got time for one more quick question.
All right, Tamar, let's talk about, well, my question is selfishly, any more big guests lined up for Breakdown?
We'll have to wait and see. We're asking a whole bunch of people to come, including Nathan Wade. We would love for him to come on. So hopefully, you know, if he's listening, we'd love for him to join us as well. Our next episode is going to be a mailbag later this week where we answer questions from listeners. So if you have a question, send me an email. We're going to record today and drop it later this week.
Tamar.Hallerman?
Yep.
At AJC.com. Tamar, you came back from your post, where Tia is right now, from Washington. It's been a number of years now. But when you came back, you were working on a lot of special projects and taking your time working much more slowly, carefully to put together the projects you cared about. And suddenly you got caught up in the what is the trial of the century, certainly in Georgia. What's the ride been like as we say goodbye to you?
You know, I handed the reins to Tia in Washington and I thought, I am done with politics. And so it is laughable that I am where I am now. But you know what? It is the story of my lifetime. I'm obsessed with it. It's so interesting. And I'm so excited to wake up every day and tell this fascinating story.
Well, Tamar Hallerman, we're really grateful. When we've called upon you to do our show, you've been really willing and we appreciate that. People should listen to this episode of Breakdown, the interview with Ashley Merchant. And just thank you so much for being with us, Tamar.
Anytime.
We're going to take a break right now. The session is about to end tomorrow. We're going to talk to two members on either side of the aisle, GOP Majority Leader Chuck F. Strachan and Democrat Representative Mary Margaret Oliver. You're listening to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach. An air freshener can make your car smell like paradise. A drive to Daytona Beach will actually get you there. Beach on. Plan your trip today at DaytonaBeach.com.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I'm Bill Nygut, along with Tia Mitchell in Washington. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from the AJC politics team. Just go to ajc.com/newsletters and sign up today. That's ajc.com/newsletters. I'm Bill Nygut, joined by co-host Tia Mitchell in Washington. The session ends tomorrow, and there are still a lot of interesting bills that are hanging in the fire that are going to play out over the next day or so. So we wanted to bring in two members of the House, Republican and Majority Leader Chuck F. Strachan and Democrat Mary Margaret Oliver. We're very grateful that you would both join us today. So let me start by asking a broader and more general question. And Majority Leader F. Strachan, let me start with you. If you still have one day left, but if you were going to characterize the tone, the tenor, the trend lines, the philosophical politics of the session, what would you say right now about what this session has been about?
Well, good morning, Bill. It's great to be with you. I feel like it's been a very productive session. So we have really moved the needle on many important issues that we've discussed for many years. Of course, education, public safety, fiscal responsibility continue to be our priorities. We're working through the state budget right now and the conference committee. And those will be reflected in the state budget, I expect, but also very meaningful reforms that that have been discussed for years. I carried a bill to address homelessness, which I'm very proud of passing yesterday at the State House. There was a very important bill with protection of tenant rights, which is the most meaningful bill, I think, on tenant rights we've passed in probably decades, and paid parental leave, bringing that to 6 weeks for state employees. That bill passed under Speaker Burns and Speaker Pro Tem Jan Jones' leadership in the House. So it's been a productive year.
Mary Margaret Oliver, how would you describe what this session has been in general for you?
Good morning. Good morning, Bill. We began the session with the painful reapportionment process that resulted in some very harsh results for Democrats. And that continued through the session to play out in some ways. And then we have what is a major disappointment for Democrats last week, the governor's intervening not to allow expansion of Medicaid. There was a great deal of energy spent on really having hope that Medicaid could be expanded. And the governor, I believe, intervened to stop it. Now we're at a spot where we're going to finish the agenda for this year in the next 30 hours, and there are major bills left on the table. I am pleased that the House Bill 404, housing, some minor reforms, some good reforms, though, was passed yesterday, and the budget will play out as to what extent we will begin and additionally add monies for some homeless programs. That's one of the issues in contention as the budget is resolved in the next day.
Tia, we should point out, as I turn to you, that when Leader F. Strachan talks about the bill that he sponsored to give some protections to tenants, some of that, certainly the impetus for that, comes out of the AJC series, Dangerous Dwellings, which was an extremely powerful look at the kind of conditions in which many, many people in rental housing properties that are not maintained well at all are living today. So we give props to our AJC colleagues. But Tia, jump in.
Yeah, and that was actually one of my first questions. As you guys, you know, the AJC, our crack team at the Capitol, Mark Nisi, Michelle Baruchman, Greg Bluestein, Maya Prabhu, Patricia Murphy, you know, there's a lot of journalism, plus the investigative pieces like the Dangerous Dwelling series. How much does that inform you guys? How much do you rely on journalism on these topics to help you either shape legislation or decide what you should support? And I'd like to hear from Rep. Frustration first.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for the question. I think a good working relationship with journalists here at the Capitol is so very important. First of all, we're passing very meaningful measures for the people of Georgia and getting that message out to them so they know the great work that we're doing here at the Capitol is so important. But also, when important issues are identified by the media and we need to take legislative action, just like the Dangerous Dwelling series that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution published, that can bring about important legislation like House Bill 404, the Safe at Home Act. Speaker John Burns really led the way to see this bill pass, with Chairman Casey Carpenter being the primary sponsor. And I was proud to co-sponsor along with my colleague here, Representative Oliver. And I think that that was a very meaningful measure that resulted from the very concerning information we had seen in that reporting. And so I think an important partnership with journalists to understand issues that are identified and also to communicate out what's truly happening here at the Capitol is important for policymakers.
Mary Margaret Oliver, it's certainly true that this session, as in past sessions, House Democrats and Republicans are able to work together to pass any number of meaningful bipartisan measures. You certainly know that as well as anybody, given the work you've done across the aisle on passing important reforms in terms of mental health care in the state. But you'd mention things like the failure to expand Medicaid fully. You're going to have to look tomorrow at this so-called Franken bill coming over from the Senate, which has a number of hot button culture war matters involved in it. So how do you how do you think about the bipartisan work you can do, but say what happens when you can't get any traction on Medicaid?
Let me answer Tamara's question first. Tia's question first. The series on housing was pivotal. It does draw our constituents' attentions to matters that they probably already know about on some level in their neighborhood. I'm in and out of the courthouse, and I know to the extent to which the COVID, the eviction process, the marshaling process, all was really slowed and broken. So the series was important. Bipartisanship is a call that constituents ask for. The most significant criticism of Congress in D.C. obviously is based on their failure on any meaningful level from the outside, it looks like, to have any bipartisan work. The Republicans right now, as I'm looking at the close votes in the last week on some of the issues that draw good attention, have a 2-6 vote margin, I would say, to obtain a success on a bill they want. Realistically, that's usually, for most of our work, enough for them to carry the day without Democratic support. However, it is more meaningful. Legislation, major legislation, is really not passed, in my view, in the view of more experienced people than me, unless there is some bipartisan participation. And the mental health work, based on the leadership of David Ralston, is a good example of that. He said in the beginning, it has to be bipartisan. It has been. It continues now in our third year for passage of reforms. So it's an essential element of our process, but it's also recognizable that the Republicans have enough votes on most days, on most issues, to do what they want to. And if the House is the more mature body, I'll just say the more mature body right now, and I will be surprised if the House allows the Senate Franken-awful bill to come to the floor. That's one of the major things Democrats are watching, because that is a extremely painful anti-trans, anti-gay, anti-librarians. I mean, it's a mixture of message bills. And if that bill is allowed to come forward in any successful way, it's going to be very painful, and it's nothing about it's going to be bipartisan.
Well, Representative Estration, I throw the ball to you on that. The Senate does. It's no secret that the Senate has been for a number of years now the much more conservative body, willing to pass culture war kinds of issues that the House has often just put aside. But you do have this bill coming at you tomorrow, which, among other things, it has measures that seem to punish transgender students. Mary Margaret Oliver mentioned some of the other issues that are in that bill. What's your sense as leader of whether the House is going to want to take all of that up tomorrow?
So, first of all, this is the late stage of the 40-day session when bills are attached to each other and bills can take a different form. And I know that Representative Amari Crawford worked very hard on the bill that he passed out of the House. He is a very hardworking member who I have tremendous respect for. And I think there's probably nothing more frustrating than your bill being changed from what you originally passed and your name being associated with legislation that you haven't necessarily worked on. I think that as the Senate is passing many bills right now, we are reviewing all the legislation that's passed. We'll put it through an analysis of whether we think it's good policy for the state and if it needs to be amended in order to be considered. And my view is the House has been very responsible in a conservative manner over the past few years. We have exhibited tremendous fiscal responsibility for our state that's put us with a $16 billion surplus. We've passed good measures that matter to all Georgians, like the ones I referenced earlier on this interview. And I feel that you'll continue to see that out of the House. There's generally bipartisan support for many of the bills that we pass. I would just guess 80% plus of the bills that are passed in the House have a unanimous or close to that vote. And so I think that's important to recognize when there are disagreements. It's on very specific issues, and it's really under those circumstances that we have those more narrow vote counts.
Rep. Estration, I want to kind of drill down a little bit more on this bill. Number one, Omari Crawford is a fellow FAMU rattler, so I take more interest in his legislation. But I also thought in today's Jolt, we quoted him, and he said it was particularly to him egregious that some of the language added to his teenage suicide prevention bill. We need to, you know, like you said, he worked hard on this. Suicide prevention added language that even if you agree, you know, transgender rights and you don't believe that transgender kids should have those rights, it's kind of research shows that they are at high risk for suicide. And so he said that was particularly to him hurtful that language that could increase teenage suicide was added to a bill meant to prevent teenage suicide. So I want to ask you, Rep. Estration, just personally, do you think what the Senate did to the bill is, do you support what the Senate did to this bill?
Yeah. So first of all, as I said, having your bill amended to be something different than what you originally proposed is a very frustrating aspect of this process. The Senate has done that to my legislation in the past, and that can be very difficult when you're working so hard to advance your issue. Suddenly, your name is attached to something that you haven't worked on and potentially don't support, as we're hearing here. This issue that that you brought up is one that was debated in the House last year. And I think that what you have heard is that there's an interest in protecting children and ensuring that that's done in a measured, appropriate way. And so this bill, as it comes over, is going to be reviewed in the House, just like all the other Senate legislation that we've received. And it's pretty considerable when the body got, I think the Senate was in until midnight last night. So a lot of bills have come over. There's a lot to consider. And we're doing that today and will be tomorrow on the final day of the legislative session.
Representative Oliver, if I want to read between the lines of the majority leader, it doesn't sound to me like this Franken bill, at least all of it, is going to go very far in the House. What are you hearing about from your Republican colleagues about this, in addition to what you're hearing now from the majority leader?
I think all us House members are standing a little taller in comparison to the Senate's antics and gamesmanship. I was the second signer on Amari Crawford's bill. He's a rattler athlete and focus on the tensions and stresses around athletes is something that is known to the members of the House. They cared about this bill, and it's insulting to the House. And I think that the competition between the House and the Senate is relevant to our conversations. And I think the House, I'm certainly hoping that the House will take a more mental health oriented approach to House Bill 1104.
It does seem, Representative Oliver, that what you're saying is correct. Certainly, there are fights between Democrats and Republicans in the House about issues like expansion of Medicaid is one example, but it's become this session, the back and forth between the House and the Senate seems to be more toxic than it's been for some time, at least. Do you feel that's true? For instance, you're going to take up tomorrow the election measures which the Senate passed, which include reducing the number of machines available for people to cast their ballots on in precincts. It's going to make it possible to have your ballot posted online so people get a chance to inspect them. There are other aspects of it. Is that another bill that's coming over from the Senate that's simply not necessary?
The election bills, the Clarence Thomas bill, 1104, are potentially very painful things. It's hard for the public to see this as much as we feel it inside the Gold Dome. The competition, I've served in both the House and the Senate, as you know, and in the Senate, a third of the body is running for another office. I was one of them, so I can say that with real knowledge. And it changes the tone. It changes the politicalization, the messaging. And I'm very happy now to be on the House side. In the style of David Ralston and John Burns, certainly very conservative leaders, but leaders that are responsible. Lieutenant Governor Jones kind of has a free rein over there to let folks in his Senate caucus who are what you'd say might say on the far right to do whatever they want to with creating the chaos that we have today. We have major important issues to resolve. The property tax issue, I think, is one that's very important to the House and Senate. The budget is always the most important document we pass. And to be distracted by these political messaging, I'm running for new office, is kind of painful at this stage.
Well, you're talking now about your belief that Lieutenant Governor Jones is already sort of beginning the earliest stages of a race for governor in a couple of years, yes?
Well, I'm talking about a third of the Senate.
What oh, okay.
The they're all running for some. I say this with experience and maybe a little cynicism. The Senate is a body that is perceived as a stepping stone to run statewide. And they use that platform to prepare their campaigns. And for the most part, my personal political opinion here, is that that's not very helpful to doing the most meaningful, smart work that we have to do in the major issues that we have left in the next 4 hours.
See, we got time. You've got get one and I get one before we have to take a break.
I just wanted to quickly, what is the most important bill that you want to see make it the distance tomorrow?
Representative Oliver, start with you and then Rep. Estration.
Budget, budget, budget. In the third year of mental health reform, the way in which we are in conflict with the Senate over mental health funding, homeless particularly, but a good number of other issues that are at play right now are important to me. I think this property tax bill started out in the House as a responsible bill to grant some additional homestead exemptions statewide. But what the Senate did without any numbers to calculate what their cut to the local school systems did is very concerning to me. So I'm nervous about that. I'm hopeful about the budget.
Leader Estration?
I'm focused on child protection measures such as the with the AI and this new new technology that there are. We have to update the criminal code to prosecute folks who are seeking to be abusive to children. And so there is legislation right now that passed out of the House, sponsored by Representative Brad Thomas, to crack down on that. And I want to see that that gets passed through, if not in the bill that was passed out of the House, that it's attached to another bill. We've got to keep Georgia children safe despite these advances in technology that are happening in the area of AI.
Well, I'm really grateful. We've got to get to a break, but as you face a final day that could take you well past midnight tomorrow night, Mary Margaret Oliver, leader Chuck Estration, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I wish you well. I hope you all have hearty breakfasts tomorrow morning. Take your vitamins and get set for a long, long day. We'll be following it all and reporting on it here on Politically Georgia. We're going to take our final break. When we come back, what's it like to cover Marjorie Taylor Greene in Washington? Well, Tia Mitchell can tell you. We'll talk about that in just a moment. This is Politically Georgia from the AJC.
Hip-hop is a product of Black people. It's a product of Black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents...
Hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny...
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at ajc.com/hip-hop.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We've got a great offer for Politically Georgia listeners. For a limited time, if you subscribe now, you'll get digital access to the AJC for $1.99 per week for life. That's right. Subscribe now by going to ajc.com/start. ajc.com/start and get ajc.com for $1.99 per week for life. It's a great deal for a greater Atlanta. And this is for new subscribers only. Tia Mitchell, as we've said, the House and Senate are in recess. But before they left, Marjorie Taylor Greene, once again, spoke out, gathering a lot of media attention because she said that she does not think the Speaker of the House is acting in the best interests of some of the most conservative members as he as he makes compromises on spending legislation. She wants tougher enforcement at the border and a variety of other things. So she's filed a motion to vacate the speaker's chair, which she is not going to take to the floor unless she feels it's necessary. It's a shot across the bow, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's created a new round of discussion about what could happen if there is another floor vote on whether the speaker should be removed. Now, remember, when Kevin McCarthy first was being installed as speaker, it took 12 rounds. Then he was removed. Of course, that happened in the first round. That was in late September. And then for 3 weeks, there was these series of votes on the House floor because Republicans would put someone up as speaker and they couldn't get a majority because there would be enough Republicans who didn't support that person. And then, of course, all the Democrats would not support that person. What's different now for Speaker Mike Johnson is the majority is even thinner, which means only if all Democrats continue to oppose Speaker Johnson and Marjorie Taylor Greene does call for this vote, she only needs like one or two people to also vote with Democrats against Mike Johnson and he's gone. But will Democrats support keeping him? Are there Democrats who, for the first time this year, because there have been a lot of votes, but for the first time this year, will Democrats vote to keep a Republican as Speaker? The question is, it is all tied to funding for Ukraine.
Ukraine, absolutely, which is something that Marjorie Taylor Greene and some of her colleagues on the far right really continue to oppose, at least until they get more for the border, right?
Right. Well, they and that's the thing. So putting money for Ukraine might help Johnson get Democrats' votes to keep him as Speaker. But the more Democrat votes that he gets tied to money for Ukraine, he will also lose Republicans' votes. For example, Representative Mike Collins, he's backed Speaker Johnson. He doesn't back everything Speaker Johnson has done, but he has backed Speaker Johnson to remain a Speaker. Mike Collins does not support money for Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Could that cause him to then turn on Speaker Johnson, for example? That is what becomes really messy and interesting. That's why you can imagine over these next 2 weeks, a lot of people are going to be reaching out to Marjorie Taylor Greene, people who are backing Speaker Johnson to try to talk her out of ever moving forward with calling for a vote to remove.
So we're going to watch that with you as it all unfolds. But we've only got a couple minutes. But give us just a little insight about covering Marjorie Taylor Greene. There. Is it easy to talk to her? Is it easy to get? I mean, she likes media.
She likes media. It's easy as long as you know where to find her, which as long as it's not cold or raining after votes, she's going out on the front steps of the Capitol, which is really strategic because usually outside of the Capitol, it's open to the public.
Yes.
Every now and then they shut it down if there's someone high profile in the in the building. But that means you don't have to be a credentialed member of the media. Anybody can interview Marjorie Taylor Greene on the steps of the Capitol. If you saw what happened after those votes last week, there were literally dozens of reporters.
She was mobbed. Yeah. We always see her as so aggressive and angry. What is she like as a, you know, when you talk to her just in real life?
Right. She's not. And I don't think you were there last year. She was actually our guest at the congressional dinner in 2023. Yeah. And she got to meet like our publisher and our now editor in chief. And she actually, you know, I always tell people politics aside, because, yes, her politics are very problematic and for many people abhorrent. But she's not hard to talk to, especially when there are not TV cameras around. She definitely, and we've covered this a lot in the AJC, when she's speaking to a more moderate or mainstream audience, she doesn't kind of parrot the far right persona that she kind of cultivates online. There's like a different side to her, a very suburban mom, which she is. That's kind of her demeanor in a lot of interactions. Again, when the TV cameras aren't off and when she's not talking to, you know, the far right social media.
Tia, she must be fascinating to cover as a journalist up there. We're completely out of time for the show today. Tia Mitchell, it's always fun to be with you as a co-host of Politically Georgia. Before we leave you, we want to remind you that, oh, by the way, Tia will be back with us on Friday. But before we leave you, we want to remind you that if you have a question for us, you can call our mailbag hotline. The number is 770-810-5297, 770-810-5297. Shaney B. and his army of interns will screen your calls and pick some out that we will answer on the Friday edition of Politically Georgia. That's all the time we have for today's podcast. You can hear Politically Georgia live weekday mornings at 10 on 90.1 WABE in Atlanta, or do what you're doing right now. Follow Politically Georgia on your favorite podcast app and hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again tomorrow for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.